You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back if you're rejoining us. Happy 5 o'clock hour. I'm Maggie Dawn, your host here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Some breaking news to start the hour. The death toll in Texas has ticked up to a grim 111 souls, with over 110 people still unaccounted for and missing. And in North Carolina, flash floods have cost four North Carolinians their lives as well. In other news this day, President Donald Trump has now decided that the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing, remember all those MAGAs standing outside the White House with binders that were supposed to be the Epstein files? Remember Dan Bongino talking about Epstein for months and months? And now, apparently, no big deal. The FBI and Trump's DOJ have concluded, no, they're there. Nothing to see. And that client list that Pam Bondi told us was sitting on her desk waiting for her review, now she says that never existed. So some very bizarre things happening in the entire spectrum of the Epstein ickiness and criminality. Keep in mind, folks, that there are hundreds of photos of Donald Trump with Jeffrey Epstein spanning over 20 years. And the Epstein creepiness isn't constrained to Donald Trump or Republicans. Many Dems also sullied their reputations irretrievably by their association therewith. I don't know about you, but I'm not inclined to believe Pam Bondi or Dan Bongino when it comes to this stuff. Not really credible folks, are they? In addition, today, Donald Trump apparently has newly figured out that Vladimir Putin may lie, stating at a cabinet meeting that we get a lot of BS thrown at us by Putin, if you want to know the truth. He's very nice to us all the time, but it turns out to be meaningless. Anyone else terribly embarrassed that it has taken our president this long to come to this very obvious and evident truth that the entire intelligence apparatus of the U.S. government has known for decades? I don't know. Does he sound like a middle schooler that's a little ticked off that his best friend was actually just playing him? I don't know. It sounds like it to me. And in other breaking news, Donald Trump, again, from a televised cabinet meeting, apparently revising U.S. tariff policy and announcing absolutely crippling tariffs on numerous products, including copper and pharmaceuticals. Hey, are you paying too much for your drugs right now? You want to pay more? Just thank Donald Trump. He's working on it, folks. And thank goodness we have just the guest to help us understand all of this mess. Her name's Lindsay Owens. She's a consumer advocate and the executive director of the economic think tank Groundwork Collaborative. Lindsay, it's great to have you back on the show. Thanks for making time.
Thanks for having me.
So, to state the obvious question, what the heck has just happened over the last couple of days with tariff policy? It seems that the needle has moved a considerable amount yet again.
Yeah, so last week, Donald Trump and Republicans in Congress finished up their big legislative effort, which was to pass their giant tax and budget bill, giving huge tax cuts to the wealthy and really sticking it to everyone else with cuts to healthcare, higher costs for food and energy along the way. And wasting no time, this week on Monday, he's running back his Liberation Day play, announcing a fresh round of tariffs on a whole host of our major trading partners and on some of our major imports like copper. So not only has he actually delayed the July 9th deadline for tariffs, pushing that back to August 1, but he's also introduced a host of new tariff proposals. And I think the punchline here, the bottom line for Americans, is that we're going to get the lose-lose trade policy scenario. We're going to get the high cost for American consumers because many companies have already gone ahead and adjusted their pricing in anticipation of these tariffs coming online. But we're not going to get any of the investment that we were hoping for as a result of trade policies that prioritized American manufacturing, because companies cannot make any decisions about investing in manufacturing in the United States, about bringing additional supply online, if they don't actually believe Trump is going to follow through with his trade policy. And it would be impossible and frankly unwise for businesses to assume he will, given that there is nothing in the last, you know, 3 months of recent history that suggests he's going to stay the course with any of this trade policy.
As an economist, I know two things that I think also resonate with folks that might not have gone to graduate school for economics. And that is business owners and markets and their 401k portfolios do better when there is predictability and stability in U.S. both domestic economic policy and international economic policy. That's thing one. Thing two is tariffs are taxes on consumers as well as businesses that build and assemble things that we, the American middle class, then purchase. It is a sales tax, in essence, that definitely gets passed on. Those two things are immutable, constant truths that no matter what Donald Trump says, he cannot deny. And polls about his economic policy are indicating that Americans are losing confidence, including amongst Republicans. Why is he doing this?
Yeah, I mean, just to underscore your point, I think the economic uncertainty that Trump's trade policies are causing are just having huge ripple effects across the economy. So the latest data that we have from manufacturers, the Dallas Fed every month surveys manufacturers, tries to understand how they're feeling as a sort of look ahead. And we found that their outlook index dropped significantly last month in the latest reading. And they cite uncertainty around tariffs as their absolute top concern. We also know that in the first half of 2025, companies announced almost 750,000 job cuts, again, citing this uncertainty in the economic environment as the main reason for their hiring and layoff decisions. Consumer confidence is down. Spending is starting to be down. GDP is negative. So you're exactly right that the uncertainty in the economic outlook and in the economic environment is really having ripple effects across the whole economy, on the labor side, on the manufacturing side, and now on the consumer spending side as well.
Lindsay, there was a bit of breaking news just before I came on air about an hour ago that the Supreme Court has now greased the skids for Donald Trump to fire tens of thousands of federal workers and begin the dismantling of various federal agencies. The uncertainty, no matter what its source, in an economy is bad. When federal government agencies that provide key support and services, like, for example, the Housing and Urban Development Agency. Again, all of this injecting increasing amounts of uncertainty. Where does it all go? Like, what's the off-ramp? I just don't, you know, usually tariffs, and I'm not anti-tariff in all circumstances, right? Surgical with particular objectives that once achieved, the tariffs then ramp back down. They can be pro-competition, or at least trying to level playing fields for U.S.-based businesses. They have a purpose. What's the purpose here? Where are we going to get relief from this systemic uncertainty that appears to be slowly but surely seizing up the American economy?
You look, it's hard to determine what the purpose here is other than, you know, Donald Trump's ego, right? He is, I think, really interested in playing these games with foreign countries and seeing who will cry uncle and who he can bring to their heels first. It is really hard to follow what's happening in trade policy in the Trump administration and see a coherent economic through line. That's just not what we're seeing here. But to pick up on your point about firing federal workers, I think the last couple of months, but in particular over the weekend, we have seen so clearly how essential federal workers are across our country. I think, you know, there's an attempt to malign federal workers, but really most federal workers across the United States are doing really important things. They're in our Fish and Wildlife Service, they're in our agricultural schools in rural areas, but they're also the first responders when we have a natural disaster or an extreme weather event, like we're experiencing in Texas and North Carolina right now. So I just think it's incredibly foolhardy to be gutting these federal agencies that are so critical to the safety and security of the American public and to our economic health as well.
Not only, I think, is it creating the uncertainty that we've been speaking of, it's essential to the quality of life in many ways. And that will end up impacting consumer confidence, not in the next 6 weeks, but in the next 6 to 16 months, as people become more fearful for their futures. Again, that will lead to reduced consumer spending. Tell people all the time. 70% of U.S. GDP is consumer spending. Billionaires don't spend money. They make money. The consumer class, the engine of our economy, is the middle class.
Yeah. Delayed Social Security checks, delayed veterans benefits, all of that stifles consumption. All of it really sort of takes a cut out of our ability to consume. And those have real ripple effects across the economy. You're exactly right.
Folks, we're talking with Lindsay Owen. She's a consumer advocate, executive director of the economic think tank Groundwork Collaborative, about the big, brutal bill's impact on the middle class and how it's getting worse, not better, with literally every passing day, including the last 2 days, where Donald Trump, with verbal, unedited stream of consciousness articulation of maybe some kind of economic policy, but maybe not, as he pushes deadline after deadline back for his tariff taxation terror. Speaking of T words, Lindsay, I want to begin when we come back. We got to take care of a few important messages, but maybe we can give our listeners a wee bit of a flavor. I call it trickle up economics. Meaning, we're going to actually tax the middle class and the working poor more, which is the effect of the big, brutal bill. We're going to cut all of the critical services that middle class and working families and veterans and disabled folks and caretakers rely upon. And we're going to use whatever we get from that great pain that we're exacting on the middle class to pay it upwards, to trickle up the wealth to the billionaire and 100 millionaire set. I want to debunk this idea of trickle down economics, because that is not the way money works. Money always trickles up. Lindsay, we got about 30 seconds. If you want to give folks a little flavor, we'll discuss in more detail when we get back on the other side.
Yeah, whether you call it trickle up, reverse Robin Hood, or as one analyst has already surmised, the single largest wealth transfer from the poor to the rich in a piece of legislation in U.S. history, the result is the same. The wealthy are going to be doing quite well when this bill goes into effect, and the poor are really going to get kicked in the teeth.
How long will it take for the big, brutal bill to kick you in the teeth and to trickle your wealth up to the people who need not a whit of it? We discuss with Lindsay Owens. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. When we come back on the other side, don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We got a great guest coming up at the bottom of this hour. His name is Jeff Mandel from Law Forward. You've heard him here before. Jeff and I are going to discuss a highly technical, don't worry, we won't bore you, we'll always keep it interesting, highly technical but crucially important Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that came down today, as well as one of the most eyebrow-raising dissents I have ever seen, written by Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Rebecca Bradley. Here on Earth One, I don't know what the hell she's talking about. But right now, we're talking with Lindsay Owen. She's a consumer advocate and executive director of the economic think tank Groundwork Collaborative. Right before the break, Lindsay, we're talking about the idea of trickle up. And if folks aren't familiar with this statistic, I will share it with them now. Since 1981, $51 trillion, trillion, TR, has trickled up from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%, according to numerous economic studies by independent and objective economists. 51 trillion. The big brutal bill just catalyzed the largest single wealth transfer on top of the 51 trillion of wealth transfer from us, the bottom 90%, again, to the top 1%. We knew he was going to do tax cuts, Lindsay. Why is this so much worse? And if you can get into a little bit, why is it that wealth always trickles up and never down?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, President Trump in his first term passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and that was a huge tax benefit for corporations and for the wealthiest Americans as well. And many of those provisions were slated to expire this year. So when Trump was reelected, it was effectively a sure thing that he was going to extend those tax cuts for the wealthy. He was not going to preside over a tax hike for the wealthiest Americans. But I think what has been so astonishing about the bill that passed last week is they went so much further than they did in 2017. The policy is just so much worse. And it's worse in one particular way. It punishes poor and middle-income Americans. So by and large, if you're an American, this bill is going to raise your cost. It's going to raise your healthcare costs. It's going to raise your energy costs. For many Americans, it's going to raise your food costs. That's because it takes away ACA coverage. It takes away Medicaid coverage. It takes away SNAP and food stamps benefits. And it also repeals a host of energy subsidies that were passed in the Biden administration to make certain products for your house less expensive, to make electric vehicles less expensive. So it is really just a brutal combination of a real heyday for the wealthy and a real punishing set of policies for everyone else. To answer your question about trickle up, you know, there's this idea that you know, really a misguided idea that was never borne out in the data. It was never true, but it became popular nonetheless, that if you did tax cuts for the wealthy or for corporations, somehow that would trickle down to the rest of us. The idea basically being that if companies had to pay less in taxes, they might do better by their workers with the extra money that they weren't sending to Uncle Sam. Of course, that never happened. And actually, the reverse is true. What we find is what companies do with these tax cuts is actually reward each other.
Yes.
They do share buybacks. They do big CEO bonuses. They cut dividend checks to their most, well-off investors. So, you know, by and large, we know historically that these tax cuts actually benefit the wealthy, and any savings that the wealthy get or corporations get from these tax cuts, they actually use to benefit themselves even further.
Yeah, that's the key piece there. The idea of trickle down was based on an assumption that tax cuts would benefit of the wealthiest, tax cuts for the wealthiest and the largest mega corporations would result, frankly, in higher wages. All one has to do is look at any objective economic research over the last 50 years to figure out that that is entirely untrue, which is interesting to me because the underlying premise of all those capitalistic, capitalism-loving folks that promote this idea is that individuals and by extension corporations, which are answering to their shareholders and no one else, they don't answer to their workers directly, they answer to shareholders, that everybody is a profit-maximizing, heat-sinking freaking missile. So why by some magical thinking benevolence of the mega corporation owners would they be like, oh yeah, minimum wage is at 7.25, but of course we'll create more generous benefits. It's bonkers. And the thing that really ticks me off, Lindsay, and I'll ask you this as our last question of the segment. This kind of tax system is terrible for entrepreneurs and small business owners because it places them at an extraordinary disadvantage relative to mega corporations that can survive economic uncertainty, tariffs, all that kind of stuff, because they're operating at such a massive, massive scale. Oh, and they also have bargaining power leverage like you've never seen with their workforce, so they can exploit their workers more. Lindsay, it's bad for small businesses and entrepreneurs as well, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that probably the best example in the bill that was just passed is the repeal of so many of the Inflation Reduction Act provisions around green energy. The big, large oil companies who are also simultaneously making climate investments won't be impacted as much. But new companies who entered the space, trying to get in on the green energy market, trying to make our economy and our climate healthier for generations to come, are really, in trouble right now. You know, back to zero in some instances, because the bets that they made on these new provisions have been completely pulled out from under them.
It's bad for you. It's bad for small businesses. It's bad for working families. It's bad for the poor. Who's it good for? 100 millionaires and mega corporations. It's a big, brutal bill. We're going to take a couple of calls when we come back and talk with Jeff Mandel about the Supreme Court case that I won't recommend you read, but that's very important. Next. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us, and happy Tuesday afternoon. We have had some big breaking news today, complete with the U.S. Supreme Court greasing the skids for Donald Trump to fire tens of thousands of federal workers, damn the consequences, and shutter federal agencies, all without congressional approval, which is an odd decision considering a couple of the dissenters in a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision issued just today about administrative rulemaking. We're going to break all that down with our next guest, Jeff Mandel of Law Forward. But first, I owe some love to some of our great callers. Eric from Milwaukee, you wanted to address the wealth transfer that we were talking about with our last guest, Lindsay Owens, from the Economic Think Tank Groundwork Collaborative. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, Eric was Robert Reed, basically the same thing.
Sorry, Eric, we can't hear you super well. I'm going to try you one more time. Be sure that your radio is off in the background, and if you are on speakerphone, take yourself off of speakerphone, and we'll try one more time. Go ahead, Eric.
I'm still here. Can you hear me now?
Yes, better. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, yes. I read an article, and so Robert Reich made the same point, but in a way that was at least easier for me to get a little more better handle on it. He said that about $50 trillion had been transferred from households that were making $200,000 a year or less to households that were making over $950,000 a year.
Yes.
And to me, that was like that hit home a little better than like 90% or 1%. It's like, well, where do I fall with that? But that was a little more concrete, at least to me.
Thank you, Eric. I will remember that and use that. First of all, Robert Reich is an incredible economist. I love reading his stuff, and he is really good at the pithy explanations. He also uses comics to explain stuff really well, too, which I love. Thanks so much, Eric. Appreciate you. We've got Jack from Merrimack on the line. Jack, I'm going to have you hold because I know your question is about this Wisconsin Supreme Court decision. So without further ado, Jeff, lovely to see you. Thanks for being here on such short notice to break down this pretty technical Wisconsin Supreme Court decision. Usually I tell people, oh, there's some juicy bits in this or that decision. You should read it. This one I'm telling people, don't bother unless you've got serious insomnia. It's for legal nerds. Tell us what this was about, at least the particular legal question, and then we'll tell people what actually catalyzed this lawsuit. Jeff, go ahead. What is administrative rulemaking, and what the heck was this case about today?
Well, thanks for having me, Maggie. Administrative rulemaking is how, for the most part, our state and federal governments go about making sure that the laws that are passed apply and protect us in our everyday lives. So an easy way to think about it is with respect to environmental rulemaking. Congress, and here in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin legislature, pass laws to make sure that we have clean, breathable air. But they can't have the expertise, and they can't update that law every single time we discover a new chemical that's hurting us or figure out exactly what percentage. So they tell administrative agencies here in Wisconsin, the Department of Natural Resources, in Washington, the Environmental Protection Act agency, they say, hey, you monitor this. Here's what we're trying to accomplish. Here are the standards we want you to use. And you tell us year in and year out how many parts per million of this particular chemical can be in the air or in the water. And that is the administrative rulemaking process. We have experts who work for the state government and for the federal government who study this stuff. And then there's a lengthy process they go through to promulgate these rules so that the public gets notice and an opportunity to comment, so that all of the people in our government have the opportunity to weigh in and make sure that this is correct. But this is not some kind of crazy harebrained scheme where you've got bureaucrats who are making rules to make people miserable with no authority. Instead, this is expert professionals working hard to carry out the specific instructions that are given by Congress or by the state legislature.
It's so critical, Jeff, that no expert that works for an agency can create a rule unless the legislature empowers them to make that rule. And if that rule, in fact, exceeds that delegation of authority, that legislative enactment, that rule can be challenged by parties impacted by it with a, here's the Latin thing, we got to do the legal nerd thing, under a theory called ultra vires, which means beyond the power, meaning the rulemaking exceeded the authority that was granted to the agency and the rulemaker by the legislature. We have a mechanism in legal theories to do that. And challenges to administrative action rulemaking are legion and legend and have gone on for decades. So what happened here? We had agencies empowered by legislation adopted by the state legislature that went ahead and made rules based on expert, objective, scientific study. And then what happened? How did this lawsuit come about?
Well, this lawsuit came about because a small committee of the legislature, the Joint Committee for the Review of Administrative Rules, which has 10 members, right? Remember, we have 99 people in the Assembly and 33 in the Senate. So we've got 132 legislators in this state. 10 of them serve on the JCRAR, as it's called. And this committee exercised a power the legislature gave it almost a decade ago to permanently suspend these rules. So again, the legislature told the agencies what to do. The agencies went through the whole lengthy process where everyone got to weigh in. The agencies made these rules, and then a handful of people in the legislature, six, right? In each instance, these votes were 6-4 in the committee, said, oh, no, you don't. And what the court said today, the governor took this to court, and the governor said, wait a second. You can't have six members of the legislature hold up the people's business indefinitely. If the legislature wants to change the law so that these rules don't go into effect, or so these agencies aren't supposed to do what you already told them to do, of course the legislature has the power to change the law, but they have to do it through rulemaking. It takes, let's go back to Schoolhouse Rock. You need a majority vote in the Assembly, you need a majority vote in the Senate, and you need the governor's signature, or if the governor vetoes it, you need to be able to override that veto. You can't have a tiny handful of people holding the law hostage, and that's what the court agreed with today.
To reiterate, the legislature legislates, meaning they create laws, but a law cannot anticipate every tiny, minute detail that will be required for the executive branch, i.e. the branch that executes the laws passed by legislatures. They can't anticipate every possible factual detail. So the executive branch agencies charged by our legislature and our constitutions, both state and federal, are then supposed to promulgate rules to give effect to the legislative intent behind these statutes that are adopted. And again, if a rulemaker exceeds that authority, there can be legal challenges. And even if they don't, as Jeff just pointed out, the legislature can then legislate again to clarify that that was not a rule that they wished to extend the power to the executive branch to make. So what I want to make really clear is, folks, have you ever watched these hearings where you've got elected officials talking about, I don't know, technology of some sort? Have you ever grimaced when a senator or some elected official stumbles terribly over the specifics of technology? Or think of, again, EPA regulations. How many of you think that your congressperson or your state assembly person is qualified to decide how many parts per billion of some carcinogen is safe for you and your family to consume? I don't know about you, but legislators are generalists. They are not subject matter experts on, well, everything. That's why you need rulemaking. So, Jeff, this is today, I'm going to put it down. Everybody listening out there, the irony of Justice Rebecca Bradley's dissent in this case and what she is claiming is going on versus what the U.S. Supreme Court just did today. It was like, forget those congressional appropriations and these congressionally created agencies. Of course the executive branch can just dismantle them willy-nilly and fire tens of thousands of federal employees. They're supposedly on the same team. Is there any rhyme or reason to what Rebecca Bradley is saying from our state Supreme Court? Is there any way to make it fit with what the U.S. Supreme Court decided today?
Well, there really isn't, as you're pointing out. And one of the things that's funny about that is how heavily Justice Rebecca Bradley's dissent today relies on work and opinions by Justice Gorsuch at the U.S. Supreme Court, who then, of course, joined the majority today, freeing the Trump administration to fire all of these people. But, you know, when you read what's challenging about reading Justice Rebecca Bradley's dissent today is fundamentally she wants to turn the clock back 120 years. And that makes it kind of a jarring read because she wants to pretend that we are still in the Gilded Age, that this is the land of the robber barons, that we live in sort of a pre-scientific society, a pre-labor society. And it's really hard to read in part because it seems so detached from reality.
Yeah.
But it's also detached from law, and I think that part is really, really important. If you have callers or listeners who do disobey your suggestion and actually read this opinion, they will see that it is littered, as legal opinions are, with citations. But almost every citation in this dissent is to a minority opinion. It is not actual law. It is a dissent, or it is a concurrence for one judge or one justice or maybe two justices. This is a sort of rump view that has not held sway in this country for more than a century, and Justice Bradley is trying to bring it back, but she's really trying in vain, and she's out here alone. No one else signed on to this dissent today.
Well, and the reason no one else signed on to it is because it's stupid. I mean, I'll call it that. Legal scholars can make anything sound smart, and I'll go beyond what Jeff is saying. The people that she's citing to are people that hold these wild theories that say that you can't have rulemaking in our constitutional republic, that the only way that we can have any rules that protect the public health, safety, and welfare is if they're directly enacted by a legislature, which, again, is both stupid and dangerous. As I have said frequently on this very program, regulations are for regular people to protect your family's health, safety, to make competition fairer for small businesses. Of course, we need to constantly review those regulations for efficiency and effectiveness. But again, regulations are for regular people, and Justice Rebecca Bradley would do away with all of them, lock, stock, and two smoking barrels. Big thanks to Jeff Mandel from Law Forward for joining me today. When we come back on the other side, I'll explain to you the rule that got the conservatives all hot and bothered in this case. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining me. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. It is the last segment of this Tuesday afternoon show. Hope your workday has been going well. Jack from Merrimack, you had a question or comment about this important yet hyper-technical Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that came down today. Go ahead, sir.
Well, first of all, let me thank you for explaining how our civil servants work, because we've got the MAGAs out there that are sowing their usual fear, hate, and anger by calling these people faceless bureaucrats and implying that their sole purpose is to just mess with your life. I mean, you did a great service by explaining how it works. I've taken those civil service exams. They're not easy. And when I was up for the job, I had both of my master's degrees, one in chemistry and one in education, checked out as well. They do a good job of vetting people that are really experts. Having said that, my question is this. It seems like the court decision said basically if a regulation is made as a result of legislation that's been both enacted by the legislature and signed by the governor, if that regulation is enacted, then is made, then that should be implemented as soon as possible. And I'm wondering if that doesn't imply, for example, that the Joint Finance Committee, which seems to like to sequester money for things like education and environment, I'm wondering if, since that has been enacted by legislation and signed by the governor, I'm wondering if there isn't an implication there that money should be spent as soon as practical.
Jack from Merrimack, great question, a reflection of the quality of listeners of all of you that participate in this program every day. Jack, what you have placed your finger upon is the distinctions between appropriations and actual expenditures, which are legally different things, and the idea of sequestration, which is a legislature or an executive branch trying to not spend money that has been appropriated, which we saw a problem with the Wisconsin Joint Finance Committee sitting on PFAS money, not spending a penny of it, though it was appropriated in a budget approved and signed by the governor. Think of appropriations and budget matters as completely separate and treated legally differently from administrative rulemaking. Things that impact our environmental regulations. That's the difference here. There are similar procedures and principles that are at issue, to wit, it would seem inappropriate and illegal for the executive branch to refuse to expend money properly budgeted by the legislature, who supposedly has the power of the purse. Right? Like, that's part of what's going on with the hundreds of Trump lawsuits, right? Because Congress has appropriated monies, they're supposed to be spent. And in fact, there are rules and laws about that. But here, this case today from the Wisconsin Supreme Court was focused on administrative rulemaking, where the state legislature passed a law, and to bring that law into effect, an executive branch agency made a rule. Now, what is fascinating here, ladies and gentlemen, is what was really going on. First of all, diehard conservatives hate all regulations, regardless of whether or not they actually work. They use things like efficiency and effectiveness and too much regulation to make us all freak out like regulations are out there to screw with your lives. They're not. Regulations are for regular people. Justice Rebecca Bradley wrote this completely bonkers dissent today because she's trying out, before Donald Trump, she had an audience of one, to try to get a federal court appointment. But what was really going on here was the fact that conservatives wanted to stop the Professional Standards Board here in the state of Wisconsin from making it professional misconduct for therapists or doctors or others that are licensed before the Professional Standards Board, like counselors and social workers, to perform and promote conversion therapy. You know, when they try to convince folks that are LGBTQIA+ that they ain't LGBTQIA+. In other words, the counselor knows who you are better than you do. That was the rule that set all of this into motion. That the scientists and medical professionals that operate our professional accreditation and licensing board wanted and clearly stated that it would be professional misconduct to conduct, endorse, or recommend this bogus conversion therapy to Wisconsinites. So this is all part of what I'm going to call the right's invented attacks on our decisions to be who we are in whatever way that we choose. That's what it was really about. And today, the Wisconsin Supreme Court turned back all of that nonsense. Don't worry, I'll carve out a little time tomorrow to talk about the Brewers game. I'm headed there myself this afternoon. Hope you have a wonderful afternoon yourself. Thanks for being with me this afternoon. Thanks for all the texting and the calls. Y'all have great questions. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it is always better when we stand together.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.